gathered by invisible forces. Everything is made up of tiny packets of energy, born in cosmic furnaces.
The atoms that we're made of have negatively charged electrons,
whirling around a big bulky nucleus.
The quantum theory offers a very different explanation of our world.
The universe is made of 12 particles of matter, 4 forces of nature. The universe is made of 12 particles of matter, 4 forces of nature. That's a wonderful and significant story.
Suppose that little things behaved very differently than anything big. Nothing's really as it seems. It's so wonderfully different than anything big.
The world is a dynamic mess of jingling things. It's hard to believe.
The quantum theory
is so strange and bizarre. Even Einstein couldn't get his head around it.
In the quantum world, the world of particles, nothing is certain.
It's a world of probabilities.
The quantum theory offers a very different explanation of our world.
The universe is made of 12 particles of matter, 4 forces of nature. The universe is made of 12 particles of matter, 4 forces of nature. That's a wonderful and significant story.
It's the Leaving Skepticism edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, our exit interview with host emeritus Ethan Klau, boycotting Russia, and Mega Vitamins Mega Myth. Let's begin episode 221.
Good.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. Place where reason and reality cross sword for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Welcome to Radio Freethinker 2.0. It's Don, your political science philosopher, now somewhat alone in the studio. Well, not quite metaphorically alone, as we sort of recast Radio Freethinker after Ethan deciding to part with skepticism for a while. But to explain himself, we have Ethan back here as our sort of exit interview. Ethan, say hello.
Hello, Don. You should know you're never alone on the radio.
Yes, there's always the cosmic rays and the aliens listening in, and...
Well, yeah, you get the background radiation from the Big Bang, you got those invisible airways sparkling with life.
Well, let's not forget the big cosmic rays that blast out whenever a neutron star explodes. This is getting really nerdy really quick.
Well, we are a nerd show.
So, Ethan.
Yes.
Let's begin this. So, let's start at the beginning and sort of help provide a context. Why did you become a skeptic?
Why did I become a skeptic? Well, that's a good question. I guess you can say he was born skeptical. I didn't really understand what that meant when I was born, but I was always very disagreeable and argumentative and
testify to that, man.
Yeah, and I irritated people a lot, and eventually I discovered that my irritation was due to logical fallacies being employed by some people and just sort of a lack of curiosity with the world. And when I started reading skeptical books like The Deep and Haunted World, which is really sort of where I understood the wider scope of skepticism, the importance of science, the importance of critical thinking, that really sort of made me an activist. I think at that point before it was sort of a thing that I thought I was the only person who thought the way I did. I didn't really understand that there was a community of free thinkers or atheists or anything like that out there.
So you were sort of a skeptic in the closet almost. I mean...
Well, I wasn't hiding the fact. I just didn't know that there was a wider community for it. I didn't realize that there was actually movements out there trying to change the world to be more skeptical.
So what was it about skepticism that sort of attracted you?
All those things that I just said.
Yeah, no, well, you mentioned your cantankerous and all that, but I mean, how do I put this? What was it that sort of drove you to start to do something about your skepticism? What was that? So you were a curmudgeon to begin with. You were born that way, right? Mm. But at some point you said, well, this isn't enough. I need to do something more. Where, how, what?
Well, I think everybody kind of goes through a phase when they reach a certain age where they want to change the world. And I think for me, when that hit, I had been exposed to Carl Sagan. I was watching Cosmos. And at that moment, I realized, you know, hey, there are actual stakes involved here. There are consequences if we don't do something to promote good science, if we're not, for example, campaigning about climate change, or if we're not talking about vaccines, or if we're not talking about some of the major issues that exist in our world, nothing is going to change. It's just going to remain the status quo. And around that time, I got exposed to sort of skeptical activism. I found out about like the Skeptics Guide to the Universe podcast. I heard about CFI, and I heard about the JREF. And that's sort of, I guess, what sort of nudged me in that direction.
So, and again, I'm going to do this in the sort of say, when you see the documentaries and they are about astronomy and they got the guy walking up the hill and saying, oh, this is a tough march. You say, well, what the heck does that have to do with astronomy? Well, I'm going to go there. So where did this inclination come from? Okay, you mentioned about your skeptical sources, but what about you that makes you want to be or were an activist? What personality traits do you think in yourself led to this inclination?
Mm. I don't really know. Like I said, a desire to make a difference, I think.
Well, why do you think you can make a difference when there are so many skeptics out there who sort of say, no, I can't?
Well, optimism, I think, plays a role. I think the fact that there is a lot of pessimism in the community of free thought, and I think being exposed to Carl Sagan early was sort of an antidote to that, the fact that he was very optimistic. One of the things that stands out for me about Carl Sagan is I remember seeing an interview with him. This was a really old interview that he was doing with Ted Turner. And he asked him about the threat of nuclear war, about climate change, about all the problems that we're facing. And he sort of said, so, you know, what are we going to do, Carl Sagan? And Carl Sagan said, you know, well, humans are fixers. We build things. We fix problems. We investigate the world. And to me, that was a very important statement because I think it made it clear that, yes, things can be bad, but we are not helpless. We're not stupid. I mean, some of us are, but most of us aren't. And we can make a difference if we, you know, roll up our sleeves and get to work. And that's sort of, you know, been my philosophy with anything, really.
So where did this then sort of lead you, at least in the beginning? Like, where did this urge to change things take you?
Well, I had just been exposed to the Skeptics Guide to the Universe podcast, and I learned about sort of the wider skeptical movement like CFI and JREF. And so when I was in Vancouver, I was away at the time. I came back to Vancouver, and I looked up campus skeptical atheist groups, and I found the UBC Free Thinkers, which networked me with like our former co-host Elon and Rob and yourself and Daniel. And that's basically where it all started for this show and for my career as a skeptical activist.
Cool. So about what time in your life did you become associated with CFI, or Center for Inquiry?
Well, I started volunteering with CFI almost right off the go, I think. I remember about maybe a year or maybe even half a year into getting the UBC Freethinkers going that I was talking with CFI volunteers and emailing different skeptical organizations and asking for advice and that sort of thing. And pretty quickly wanting to get involved with like CFI Vancouver, which at the time was still a branch of CFI Transnational. There was no CFI Canada at that stage. And
what year was this?
Oh, I'm bad at years. Okay. This was definitely maybe 4 or 5 years ago.
For the record, this is our local historian who's not good with...
I'm good with ancient history. Things that are still living sometimes confuse me.
Okay. So why did... how do I word this in a politically correct way? Why wasn't Radio Free Thinker enough for you?
Oh, well, I mean, it's... Well, there's no real polite way to answer this. I had ambitions, Don. But I think for me, when the opportunity came along to work with CFI, I was just so excited by the prospect. I mean, here were a bunch of people who were as dedicated as I was and as passionate as I was, and all had the same sort of background. People who sort of grew up as kind of the cranky family member who was a bit weird and didn't believe in God, and now they were trying to make the world a better place. And I was like, wow, these are my people. So, yeah, I mean, taking the opportunity to work with CFI was just something, oh, this is, I have to do this. I mean, I have to get involved with these people.
So I think we've got the timeline here. So basically you're saying your skepticism, as in your skeptical activism, mm-hmm. preceded your involvement in CFI, or did they sort of happen all together?
I think, well, I mean, getting involved with CFI definitely, to a certain extent, radicalized me a bit. I mean, I can recall having conversations with family members or friends about things like religion or politics and saying things like, you know, everyone, you know, has a right to their own beliefs and all that kind of stuff. And I believe, of course, you have a right to your beliefs, but I think after working with CFI and getting more involved, I realized that, you know, not all ideas are equal here. And there actually is pretty good reason to confront people about having bad or dangerous ideas. I think that they're actually, on the surface, yes, you can come across as rude and strident and angry, but on the other hand, if we just sort of tacitly say, oh, well, you know, those Catholics, let's just let them be, well, I'm happy to let them be, but at the same time, you know, they're also propping up an institution that has done really horrible things, and this needs to be addressed.
That reminds me, I just was reading the other day about a series of ghost rapes happening in a sort of a commune, for lack of a better word, in Bulgaria, where women wake up having been assaulted. And of course, no one in the, because everyone's holy in the site, so it must have been a ghost that did it, which just strikes me as odd. So traditional skepticism tends to deal with, you know, Bigfoot and atheism has become a big part of skepticism, although there's some debate about that, quack medicine, and sort of sciencey things that you can prove. Did you start from there, or how has your vision of what skepticism is, has it evolved?
Well, I was always of the opinion that atheism is just skepticism applied to religion, and that it's a logical progression. That's obviously not the de facto view in the community. I mean, we've talked about this many times. But for me, that's why I think CFI was such an attractive organization to me, was because that was an assumed position. It was just, you know, if you are critical, if you examine the evidence, you will naturally come to the conclusion that atheism is the correct position to hold. And that just sort of fit well with my own personal views on it.
But hasn't been some of the issues with CFI, especially CFI Transnational, that's not the case, that actually there is a special domain skepticism to worry about, and there are other domains that it really has no point in being?
Yeah, I mean, that's been the ongoing argument for the past 30 years, ever since Paul Kurtz, the founder of CFI, tried to combine PsyCop and the Council for Secular Humanism. There's always been people who have been saying, listen, we're skeptics, we're science cheerleaders, we don't want to be talking about atheism. I mean, there's always been atheists who have said, you know, this science religion you're promoting here is not part of our view. I just think it's really short-sighted, honestly. I think that at a certain point, we have to be able to heal that rift and say, look, we're trying to examine the world, scientifically speaking, in a materialistic way, which generally precludes the existence of the supernatural.
So if CFI was a good fit for you, why did you leave it? I mean, and I don't mean this time. I mean, you've left CFI once before.
Yeah, well, I was originally working as the executive director for the Vancouver branch. It's complicated. I wasn't happy about certain directional things that were going on with CFI at the time. I felt that there was a significant push at the time to make CFI more focused purely on sort of science and skepticism, which didn't really sit well with me. And there were other factors, like mundane job-related factors that aren't really that important. And I think that at the end of the day, I sat down with Justin Trottier, and we kind of talked it up, and I said, you know, I think maybe I shouldn't do this. Mm-hmm. And he was going, well, that's reasonable. And so I became like an advisor to the board, and I thought that was a great position to be in, and I enjoyed helping out with policy ideas, that sort of thing. And that was happy for me for a while. And then CFI obviously had different directors come in. They stayed for different amounts of time. And after the last one left, the branch was kind of in a bit of state of chaos. And so the new national director, Michael Payton, asked me to come in. And so I said, okay, well, and we were able to get things up and running. And that was about, about a year ago. And mm-hmm. been doing it since.
So you sort of created a Peyton's Place, just to make the pun. Sorry. Mm. We're going to go for a quick break, assuming I know how to work the board. And when we come back, more with our interview with Ethan.
That ship out there will be smashed to bits. Use your emergency equipment.
It won't work. Nothing works. It's got to. It's no use. Everything seems to be stuck.
My life's worth a try, anyway.
Come on, fellas. You can make it.
Just listen to this. Spider-Man saves freighter. You can't tell me the captain couldn't have brought his ship in without the help of that publicity-seeking show-off, Spider-Man!
Don't get caught wasting power. Unplug cell phone, camera, and other battery chargers when charging is complete. Many electronic devices continue to use power even when you are not operating them. The amount of energy consumed by electronics in a year when they were not in use could power Whistler Blackcomb Resorts for 43 years. This Power Smart Play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome back. So, Ethan, we've gone through your birth, you're growing up, you're maturing, you become a skeptic, you've joined CFI, you left CFI, you joined CFI, and yet I can't help but notice that you are no longer with CFI.
Yeah, so the most recent splitting up, I think, is a bit more different than the last time. CFI decided, the board of directors decided to change the direction of the organization, and they relieved Michael Payton as the national executive director. Obviously, this came as quite a surprise to myself and some of the other branch leaders, and due to different factors, I decided that it was no longer the organization for me and decided to move on. I mean, this also had, unfortunately, corresponded with personal life issues. It corresponded with difficulties I was finding with skeptical activism in general, that I felt like we were sort of sitting in a rut, spinning our tires. And I think I kind of had a moment where I kind of realized we've had some successes, of course, but largely we're in kind of the same position we've been in for the last 4 or 5 years. And I think that at a certain point, I've kicked the tires enough. It's time to move on.
You've talked about some of the internal politics of CFI that contributed to sort of moving past CFI, but why does it mean that you no longer attend things like Skeptics of the Pub or other skeptical events? It appears that you've not only left CFI, but you're also sort of abandoning skepticism itself. Now, maybe I've misunderstood you, and maybe you meant, you know, any CFI-sponsored events and not skepticism itself.
I think it definitely is more of a skeptic thing, because as I talked about in my blog post, there are some pretty significant issues in the skeptic community that are not being addressed and haven't been addressed since the foundation. And I can go through a couple of them if you're interested.
Well, I will come to that. So you mentioned that your blog post, The Candle Is Out, which was, to be fair, somewhat of a downer.
I'm sorry about that.
Now, do you really think, and I'm going to quote from your blog here, that skeptics are mean? I mean, really, you, God. No, sorry, I'm not going to be mean to you. So what did you mean by that?
Well, basically, this is something that originally when I first was getting involved, people would say to me, Ethan, you're being rude, or Ethan, this is nastiness, and I would kind of go, oh, grow up, you know, get real type thing. It was when other activists started telling me this, like when I would network with other executive directors and other charities, or if I was talking with somebody from a different organization, and they said to me, you know, I don't know how you deal with these people, or that's really rude, or this is terrible, and like this is not how you do things. I started to sort of wake up and go, when the rest of the community of nonprofit like workers are saying to you, something's not right about this, you kind of have to sit back and go, maybe they're right. And one thing that I started to realize was that a lot of the kind of the nastiness, a lot of the backroom kind of cloak and dagger material that goes on in the skeptic community is somewhat unique in the sense that it is can get quite nasty, quite personal, and it's not very productive at all. And this is one of the things that I think a lot of the, you know, the attendees of events and people who go to Skeptics in the Pub may not realize, but there is an awful lot of gossip that goes around in organizer circles that is quite petty at times, literally to the point of, you know, saying things like, I don't want to work with that person because they didn't like my idea about a skeptic bowling night or something, you know? Like, it really kind of gets to a very kind of personal level that is just unpleasant to be around.
Well, what about the things, and we were talking about this before the show, and I mean, we don't want to veer off too far in this direction, but there's been recently a number of allegations of major sexual assault mm-hmm. in the skeptic community and threats of lawsuits over such things. I mean, on the one hand, I mean, this has nothing to do with skepticism per se. It does seem very, I'm trying to think of the right word. I'm going to say offensive, but if it's true, then it's not offensive. But I mean, it's very aggressive either way.
Yeah, and one of the problems that I've been thinking about this is that the skeptic community, you know, relies a lot on blogs and podcasts to sort of update the larger community about what's going on. Unfortunately, blogs and podcasts don't really adhere to any kind of guidelines or journalistic responsibilities. I mean, not that journalists appeal to them either, but you know what I mean. And if somebody goes out there and blogs something and says, ex-skeptic sexually assaulted somebody, justifiably, that's a libelous statement. You should, without evidence to back that up, that person has been, their career could be jeopardized by that.
Yeah, but let's bring this back. I mean, that's not unique to skepticism.
No, it's not. It's not. But
and you did imply that some of this issue you think is unique to skepticism.
I think it is. I think that there are elements of it's hard to describe it, of group dynamics that appears particularly nasty or particularly vindictive that I've encountered that I haven't heard about happening in other nonprofits or other activist circles.
It's been a while since you've been to the church group, but okay.
Yeah.
Well, maybe we'll try this from a different angle then. So you also quoted, the best thing about free thinkers is that they're free thinkers, and the worst thing about free thinkers is that they're free thinkers. What did you have in mind when you said this?
Well, the common expression that I've heard is organizing skeptics is like herding cats, and that it's very difficult to convince other skeptics to go along with an idea or a plan. And I don't know, like, there's probably millions of reasons why this happens, but it's just one of the things that I've encountered many, many times. Now, part of the problem this generates is that it can be very difficult to get organized and do anything. If you can't get a group of people to sit down and agree on a strategy or a plan or an event, you often end up just doing nothing. And I've actually experienced this where, you know, you organize a group of people to sit down Thursday night. You convince them either to meet on Skype or meet in an office somewhere. You all get there. Someone shows up late. You get talking. And after like an hour and a half, you leave with no concrete plan whatsoever. And it's just this very common problem that skeptics don't want to be led. They don't want to be told what to do. They don't want to have a leader stand up and say, I'm going to do this. And part of that is a good instinct. We don't want to have charismatic leaders who sort of control the movement. But on the other hand, it makes it very difficult to do anything when there's just no consensus on how to get something done.
But when similar issues arise in something like the libertarian political groups, who, again, emphasize much more on the independence and self than, you know, skeptics do. But I think you're getting at that sort of a common thread between the both, which is why you find a lot of libertarians in the skepticism.
Well, exactly. That is a common, I think, a connection between the two ideologies, libertarianism and skepticism, is that there is definitely a feeling of the individual matters a lot, and we're not going to be susceptible to groupthink, so we're just not going to work it together as a group.
But in the United States, the third oldest political party, actually I think it's the second oldest political party in the United States, is the Libertarian Party, right? Mm. I mean, they never won anything, but still they've had a long history. They have Ron Paul and Rand Paul, etc., as leaders of their group. How come they seem to have managed to jump this hurdle, and you think that skeptics can't.
Well, I mean, skeptics do have leaders. We do have James Randi or Michael Shermer or Ron Lindsay, who lead these groups that have been around for a long time. The question is, what are they accomplishing? What are they doing? I mean, you mentioned the Libertarian Party. They've never won anything. They've been around. And granted, you know, Randy's been on 60 Minutes a couple times. He's done shows. CFI has occasionally gotten into the newspapers. But have we made significant contributions?
Well, let's go back to, and again, maybe it's hard to see things from where you are. But the you mentioned Carl Sagan. I mean, Carl Sagan was sort of a tireless proponent of skepticism. And in a lot of ways, he gave birth to the movement we now have that you have issues with, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it does seem like at the time when one is sort of in the waves, it's hard to see that there's any land. But the land is there and you're moving towards it. Or do you think that's a bad analogy?
Well, the interesting thing about Carl Sagan was that he wasn't really a group founder. And to a certain extent, he wasn't as on board with the free thought movement as I think we would like to think he was. I mean, he was definitely a promoter. I mean, he's more like I think of like Neil deGrasse Tyson as a science promoter. He doesn't want the label atheist or skeptic. He doesn't consider this movement his movement. He's a science promoter. And Carl Sagan was a science promoter. Even though there are a lot of scientists sort of look down on him for that, that's what Carl Sagan did best. And the groups that sort of were created, like CFI and like the JREF, they weren't necessarily of the same kind of... I think if Carl Sagan had his way, he probably would have wanted a more... more like a funding organization that funded science, that provided funding to send science lecturers to schools, that sort of thing. I don't think he was quite on the same page with the free thought movement.
So maybe a better model to emulate might be more the atheist model. I mean, like him or not, Richard Dawkins has sort of given new breath mm-hmm. to atheism. And in a lot of parts of the world, they have actually accomplished something. They have, you know, forwarded the rights of non-believers, and they have fought back against state-imposed of religion. So do you think maybe that's a better, if perhaps even more contentious, model to follow?
Yeah, in theory. I think that if you look at what makes a successful activist organization, like a nonprofit, it is ultimately getting things done. And you look at the ones that have been successful in the world, the Red Cross, Amnesty International, these groups that go out there, they're able to fundraise, they're able to put people in the right position to apply diplomatic pressure or to make change happen. And, you know, the Richard Dawkins Foundation has actually done a pretty good job of that. I think that they, perhaps even better so than North American counterparts, have done a better job of getting things done and getting lasting change done. But again, I'm sure, you know, people would disagree on that point as well.
Well, only the skeptics.
Yeah.
We're going to go for another break, and we'll be right back after this.
CITR is proud to support the 20th anniversary season of the Enchanted Evenings concert series at the Dr. Sun Yat-sen Classical Chinese Garden. Unwind at the end of every week with an eclectic musical performance. All concerts begin at 7 p.m. every Friday from July 5th to August 30th. For more information, go to vancouverchinesegarden.com.
And we have returned. So, Ethan, we were talking about some of the dysfunctions. There's one thing you'd mentioned in your article, and I'm hoping this will lead into building as opposed to tearing down sort of thing. A certain tension between professional activism and, I don't know, amateur activism. What were you trying to get at that?
Well, I think that there is a sizable percentage of skeptics, atheists out there, who view it essentially a hobby. They like going to skeptics in the pub. They like going to the events and socializing and being around like-minded people, which is great, and I'm not knocking that in any way. There's also a group of people who really couldn't care less about that sort of thing, and they want to get down to business. They want to roll up their sleeves, make signs. They want to protest. They want to get out there. They want to do all the hard work. And they don't always get along well. I think that there is a tendency among the activists to sort of say, okay, follow us, we're going to get things done, and the social skeptics to sort of say, we're cool dudes, chill. And it creates a bit of a conflict. And it's also unfortunate because in order to make lasting change, you need the casual person to sort of engage. They need to donate, they need to support, they need to help out. And I think that the skeptic movement hasn't quite figured out the best way of doing that just yet. I think that other charities are really good at sort of galvanizing their supporters, you know, the Red Cross or Amnesty International or any of them. They're good at saying, here's the problem, here are some pictures of it, here's some sad video. You look at it, you go, oh, I'm all riled up, I'm going to give them $50. And a lot of people do that they're able to say, okay, we can hire doctors, we can hire experts to go there and fix problems. Whereas the skeptics community doesn't have those same resources at their disposal. I mean, one of the things that I've noticed is that a lot of the people who are actually working, getting paid, are not necessarily trained professionals. They're more like really enthusiastic people. Like myself, when I first started with CFI, I was just really enthusiastic and I knew all the blogs and Carl Sagan and stuff like that. But if they went out and said, we want to hire an experienced nonprofit executive director, someone who knows how to canvass for donations, who knows how to set up a charity, you would see different results. And I remember I've been at like conferences where they've brought in people like that, people who are career executive directors. And usually their advice falls on deaf ears. It's usually like they'll give a talk, there'll be a polite pause, and that's really as far as it goes.
So what were some of their suggestions?
Well, one thing that I know is unpopular, but a lot of times we get the message that we do not know how to market ourselves. We're too strident, we're too arrogant, and we're too mean. So
yes,
yeah. Right. So it's like they a lot of the advice is tone down the rhetoric and focus on the things that you know will garner a reaction. So in Vancouver, for instance, you're not going to garner a reaction talking about atheism. Most Vancouver people just don't care. You know, what people care about in this city are pictures of starving kids and, you know, abused animals and hurt babies. So, I mean, if you're going to talk about vaccines, start talking about childhood illnesses, you know. And again, part of it is that do you want to be that charity that puts out images of, you know, crying babies on their monthly newsletter? But to a certain extent, you also need to garner the resources to advance your organization. And there's, at least in my experience, there's a sort of an unwillingness to take certain steps necessary to go that extra mile.
So sort of two parts. One, hasn't something like, you know, again, we're back to politics, but the Tea Party has sort of meshed that sort of professionalism and amateurism into something that is perhaps unwieldy, but definitely has influence.
Yeah, I mean, you can do it well, right? Like it's, the skeptic movement is small. We're very, very small. And even though there's a, like, you know, we've seen statistics that say a large percentage of, you know, BC is non-religious or atheist. I would wager that, you know, 90% of them have never even heard of the free thought movement or atheism as a movement. We're just not getting our message out there. And there's, again, probably many, many reasons why this is just not catching on. But I think a lot of it is we're not taking advantage of the resources that other charities would use. You know, an organization would actually hire a marketing firm and say, why aren't we getting our message out there? And it's going to cost a lot of money, right? And CFI would have to go to, say, their members and say, hey, listen, donate so we can hire a marketing firm to figure out why the heck we're not getting our message out there. It's the right thing to do strategically speaking, but how do you sell that to people? And further, how do you sell it to skeptics who are already hypercritical and are going to say, well, what's that going to do? You know, how is that helping things? And it's just one of those difficult aspects of being a skeptical activist.
You also stated that you think that another issue, and I suspect major issue in your eyes, is the movement, the skeptical movement somehow has to address the I want it all and I want it now sort of expectations.
Mm-hmm.
What did you mean by this?
I think one of the common trends that I've noticed is because we are skeptics, we assume that everyone's going to be a rational humanist, that we are going to be easily swayed by convincing arguments. We're going to look at evidence. We're not going to get emotional. We're not going to get reactive. And anytime a skeptic gets into an argument with another skeptic, we don't look at it as two people. We look at it as you know, usually yourself. I'm the rational skeptic. You're the irrational skeptic who's just not listening clearly enough. You're not seeing the careful evidence I'm laying out for you. And so we almost react like even more intensely than we would be if we're talking to someone who wasn't a skeptic. It's like, you know, how dare you not see how logical I'm being? And this mentality is reflected, I think, in our expectations for groups and for other activists. We expect everybody to be a perfect skeptic. And we expect organizations to have perfect track records of dealing with things. When in reality, we should know that that's just not likely to happen. We know that there are group dynamics at play out. We know that there are internal politics at play out. And we know that some people just plain don't like each other. And that's going to reflect itself in how our groups operate. And one of the things that I found frustrating is when, you know, I would get an email from somebody saying, I'm never going to volunteer again until you fire this guy who works in Halifax. Why is the guy in Halifax harassing you? No, I just don't like him. But he's in Halifax.
Yes, but he wears green. I don't like green.
It's just that there's this feeling that I get that skeptics want an awful lot. And it's not necessarily their fault, because organizations are not good at communicating what they actually need to the groups that they get their money from. I think I wrote something along the lines of the most skeptical organizations don't really understand what they should be spending their money on in the first place. And even if they did, they wouldn't tell their constituents what that is. So I suggest like a marketing firm. But an organization is not going to want to try to sell that. They're going to want to sell something like help us buy an office space or help us do an ad campaign on buses, you know. And again, I'm not saying that those are bad ideas or that those are things you shouldn't at some point consider. But by speaking from a point of view of priorities, those aren't that helpful. I mean, the bus ads are good for getting in the newspapers for like 2 weeks, and then you're gone. You know, it's not an effective use of resources.
So if suddenly the entire board of directors of CFI Canada retired and they appointed you as president... I'm gonna ask you that question, but not
okay.
quite yet.
Okay.
One of the things I thought with regards to I Want It All, I Want It Now is the inability for skeptics to really accept incrementalism.
Yeah, that's a really good way of pointing it out because, and I use the analogy of like nuclear weapons. I mean, we obviously want nuclear weapons gone, but if they said, we can't do that, but we can give you 25%, it's like, that's pretty good. I'll take 25%. And I think for skeptics, again, for whatever reason, we really expect people to just listen to us and agree. I think it's hard for us to realize that most people don't make decisions based on logic. They make them on emotion. They make them on gut instinct. And when I'm sure we've all been in this position where we're arguing with someone and we're, from our point of view, you know, speaking really logically and rationally, and they're getting angry and angrier at us, and we can't figure out why. It's because we're on different wavelengths. They're talking about an emotional state, and we're insulting them by not recognizing their emotions make them right. And so as skeptics, I think that we have sort of unrealistic expectations that we're just going to be able to, you know, put out a couple of posters that say, hey, vaccines work and they save lives, and everyone's going to go, oh, of course they do.
Well, so maybe that is your example. But what is your example where you think skeptics are asking too much and here would be an alternative increment that we really should be aiming for?
Well, as unpopular as the view is, I think that we could get a lot done by compromising with some of our liberal enemies. So, you know, I know that like people like P.Z. Myers hate this idea, but working with liberal religious organizations to make incremental change.
I almost cut your mic off.
But I think that that is a realist. Like, again, if you look at Amnesty International, are they going to turn down help from a religious organization to save somebody's life, right?
Right.
They're not. They're going to be like, if you can help us get this freedom fighter out of jail, let's go for it. And I think that we need to embrace that kind of sort of perhaps desperate thinking of saying, we need to achieve this objective. We need to get it done.
But haven't you, and obviously me, because mm-hmm. I've always admitted to being a fundamentalist, evangelical type person, but we have knocked Bill Maher, we have knocked Sam Harris for not being pure to the cause. So doesn't that kind of make your claim a bit hypocritical?
Well, I think that, again, it comes down to being pragmatic. I cannot like working with a liberal Christian organization. That doesn't mean my hesitancy or my uncomfortableness should overrule the pragmatic option, right? If, for instance, this is not a great example, but in the past, we've done things like debates with religious groups. And what we'd do is we'd host it maybe in their church. We would split the donations 50-50. And the argument against this is that, well, you're just giving them more of a platform. Yes, we are. But we're going to get way more donations splitting the gate with them 50-50, using their church, helping them advertise, than we would not doing it at all. And that donation can go to hiring staff people. It can go to, you know, everything, right? There's so many things we can use it for. And it also helps familiarize our two viewpoints with each other. It helps us build common ground. These are all good things to do. And I think that we look at it from the point of view of, well, or a skeptics kind of look at it from the point of view of, we can't risk legitimizing their point of view. They're already legitimate. They already have three times our membership base, despite being a small church in Vancouver. You know, like,
so basically, kind of a part of your argument is that, okay, we may be splitting the money that's coming in from the event, but for us, that's a doubling of our money. For them, it's a 10% increase. So yeah. Really, we're getting a lot more out of it than they are, irrespective of how you may want to look at it.
Well, I mean, one example that always blows me away is you can look at some of the smaller religions in Canada, ones that have memberships, you know, maybe in the millions, but by Canadian standards, it's very small. And they're able to fundraise like five times what CFI is able to fundraise, despite the fact that we have supposedly 25% of BC is an atheist, you know, and we're struggling to make ends meet, and they're able to afford giant churches.
But they've got God in their sign.
Well, maybe we need a deity.
Where did I put this? So you had talked before about the idea of back-channel communications. Mm. And although in our pre-sort of interview talk with regards to, you know, sexual assault sort of things, you implied that there was a lot of back-channel communication. But what's back-channel communication? What are you talking about with this?
Well, so this goes back to another point that I think I've made before in the past. But the skeptic community has a tendency to go public really quickly with disagreements. And this can be seen, you know, on Facebook or Twitter, blogs or podcasts. So let's say you say something and I take issue with it. Instead of calling you up and be like, on the phone or emailing you and saying, Don, I have an issue with what you said. Let's talk about it. I post on Facebook, what is Don thinking? Crazy idea, blah, blah, blah. Or I go on Twitter and I blast you on Twitter or whatever. And, you know, you'll respond with a response to my Facebook post, but because we're not talking, I can't tell what your tone of voice is. I'm going to misinterpret it, think you're yelling at me, and then it starts a flame war. Boom, major problem. Dan Dennett has a system in place where if he wants to take issue with somebody, he first calls them up and says, is this what you meant to say? And he writes in his most recent book, summarize their point to them in a way that makes them say, wow, I wish I thought of it saying it that way. And you might think that's lame and nice and boring, but it actually makes a difference. And if you can first sit with somebody and say, listen, I don't understand why you're saying this. I don't know why you're taking issue with this, and discuss it. And then after that, if that fails, sure, blog about it, whatever. But instead of going first to, you know, shame them or humiliate them, try to work out your disagreement first. That can go a long way to healing rifts and preventing major schisms from happening. And I think maybe a couple times I've had someone email me and say, oh, Ethan, I don't understand what you meant by this. And we talked about it and worked it out. But I've seen plenty of times when someone has taken a statement or an event or whatever and used it as an opportunity to roast somebody online. And it's just, again, this doesn't happen in other charities or other nonprofits. Other executive directors working for different groups don't blast other ones because they know each other and they know they network with each other and they learn about new jobs and new opportunities from each other. They aren't at each other's throats the way that sometimes skeptics groups are.
How much do you think of this perhaps is just when this movement has sort of taken off? I mean, to be fair, I find it hard to believe that the anti-racist sort of social equality movement of the 1960s, 50s in the United States, you know, before that, perhaps, well, I can't think of anyone before that, but I mean, that there was not a lot of infighting there, but the context of that conversation was at worst through news organizations or was forced to be personal. Whereas now, because we have instant communication, we have Facebook, we have Twitter, we have all those things, that the opportunity for misunderstanding is grown dramatically.
There's been a lot of studies out there about online communication and ways it goes wrong. And I think a huge portion of it comes down to things like you can't detect tone, you can't detect sarcasm, you can't detect inflection when you're reading a blog post or a Facebook post or something. And it's hard to tell if somebody is just taking a run at you for no other reason to just be a jerk. In fact, I think the person to talk to this about is our former co-host, Rob. I'm sure he knows a few things about this as well. But Twitter and Facebook are great, but they're not great tools for networking because they have limitations on them. And it's not the same as calling somebody up and just saying, hey, what's going on?
We're going to be back after one more commercial or break or whatever you want to call it after this.
To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Empowers you.
And we have returned, and I've lost my place in my notes. I hate when that happens. There we are. Okay, Ethan, do you think the movement, as we know it, is inevitably have a tendency towards dysfunction? Will it ever gain sort of the same credibility as you mentioned, Amnesty International, the Canadian Peace Congress, or even the SPCA? You are now in charge of skepticism in Canada. What would you do?
That's a tough job.
In 10 words or less.
Yeah. Well, I think that there are sweeping changes that need to be made. Now, I know, I want to be clear, I know a lot of people who are sticking with CFI and skeptical activism. My friend Marilee Welch is going to be the executive director of CFI Vancouver for a couple months. She's an amazing activist, and I have a lot of, I expect great things out of her. My friends Lauren Price and Zena Ryder and CFI Okanagan, amazing people. So there's hardworking people out there, and I think people should help them and support them and do what they can to advance the cause. It's not time to throw in the towel yet, but there needs to be some serious introspection when it comes to our groups. I mean, for one thing, why are there so many skeptical organizations? And if you roll back the clock, a lot of them start because a person says, that's it, I can't work with these people, I'm starting my own group. And this seems to keep happening. Why is this happening? Why can't we ever work together?
No, so why?
I don't know.
Sorry, correction. What can we do about this?
I don't know. If I had the answer, I would have done it. I think that there just needs to be some serious considerations. I mean, maybe the first step is to looking at modernizing or professionalizing our movement. Maybe from now on, instead of hiring the most skeptically knowledgeable person, look for somebody out of a nonprofit management organization. Look at instead of getting, CFI Canada, again, our board members, I know some of them personally, they're nice guys. But maybe instead of finding skeptical activists, find people who have sat on the board of directors of the Canadian Liver Foundation or BC Lung Association or the Red Cross and say, you people have done this for 30 plus years. What are we doing wrong? Why are you able to raise, $10 million and we can raise, $500,000? What are we doing wrong here?
So you think there should be some medical intervention? Because you mentioned liver, lung, and blood.
Yeah, well, I mean, or the SPCA, I guess. I don't want to disparage anyone, and I don't want to go out there and say, the whole movement is doomed. But I think that there should be, I think there should be some serious introspection.
And just to provide context, because again, it's a bit of a downer, and I guess I should start out by reiterating my condolences at your personal loss that you recently have. But I have to ask, and forgive me if this seems inappropriate, how much a role has that played in your decision to step back from things?
It played a pretty significant role. One of the issues I had was I was always able to sort of let most of the skeptical drama roll off my back, because to me it was an escape from whatever else I was doing. You know, coming here and doing Radio Free Thinker is like the highlight of my week most of the time. I love coming here. I like chatting with you. I like hanging out with everybody. But when things in my personal life started getting difficult, and the skeptic community was also, I think, I can't remember what controversy was happening at the time, but it was in volcano mode. And I was getting, you know, angry emails and people calling me out on Facebook. My instinct is to be, you know, well, screw you guys, I'm going home. And a lot of it, I think, is just I realized that I've been doing this for a while now. I've been kicking up the same tires. In my opinion, haven't made the progress that I wanted to make with it. It's time for me to find something else. And I think a lot of it is when you're going through tough personal life issues, you kind of want to say, well, maybe I need to change this pace. And for me, that was, you know, a significant portion of my decision.
So, and maybe in a follow-up post, this will come out a bit better. I think what you're not trying to be so much tearing down things, is that you sort of see this issue and you're not trying to be a mean skeptic. Mm-hmm. You're not trying to be one of those people. This is just my observations. Now I'm going to walk away and take a bit of a break. And sort of on that note, I'm trying to think of the right word here. On that note, what things in your past as a skeptic activist that you wish you could do differently? As sort of a, I did this, and this is a lesson for people who are going to follow me.
Hmm.
And that's CFI, your show, anything that you would say?
Well, I think that for me, I think that the proper training would really benefit future activists. So if it's possible for you as an activist out there, try to look into nonprofit training. Try to look into finding a mentor, someone who's been in the industry who knows a thing or two about volunteer management, about financial management, these sort of things. Those skills are really underrated in our community and can go a long way to making things better. I don't want to speak necessarily for myself because I'm perfect, but I have noticed, issues arise because somebody wasn't able to manage a group of volunteers or couldn't make their point without stepping on toes, that kind of thing. And that's the kind of training you can get from like a nonprofit course, or even just like business management. And then you can take like a night school course, you can do like an online thing, and just sort of changing our perception of where to find expertise. It's great to have a science major as a skeptical activist, but at the same time, let's not exclude the business people and the financial experts, because we need them too. And they will make a difference in helping an organization run properly.
So one of the fallacies or problems we've always had is we were experts at widgets, but we've always ignored how to sell the widget sort of thing.
Yeah.
So after all this, Ethan, today, what does skepticism mean to you?
Well, I mean, I will consider myself a skeptic. I mean, I'm still an atheist. I'm still a believer in the scientific method and establishing the truth or falsehood of claims. So it hasn't really changed me too much. I think all that's really changed is my willingness to involve myself in skeptical activism. I think that a lot of the causes that I do care about, human rights and dealing with issues like climate change or health and safety, that kind of thing. I think for me, I'm looking more at other organizations, other established groups that have track records of doing this sort of thing. I've been, in the past couple of weeks, I've been perusing like Amnesty International's policies and objectives. And it's amazing how similar they are to things we've talked about on the show. You know, like, it's almost like they listen. Maybe they do. But, you know, we have allies out there. The skeptic community does. They should engage those people. And for me, that's sort of where I've been looking at. And just sort of, I think maybe instead of defining myself as a skeptical activist, I should maybe define myself as a human rights activist or something, you know.
That sounds very fair. So it is getting almost to the end of our show. I have a skeptic highlight to maintain the tradition. In the light of recent revelations about digital spying, the shutting down of two private, and by private I mean, you know, so secure and encrypted email companies, I thought I'd let our listeners know that there are some actions you can take to avoid being caught up in the net. And no, I'm not talking about any tin hat sort of thing, and you do this as you see fit, but even people who don't have anything to hide can always be mistaken as someone who does. So if you want a sort of relatively secure chat or instant messaging conversation sort of app, I'd recommend something called Adium or Pigeon. Forgive my pronunciation. There'll be links on our webpage. These are free open source. They use private public key encryption to make sure that no one can listen into your conversations. For email, I've been trying out Hushmail, at least while it remains open. As I say, a couple of them have been shut down just recently. And for web surfing, there's a project called Tor. It doesn't use encryption for your surfing, because, I mean, if you think about it, it can't really help. If you encrypt www.microsoft.com, it'll never get there because no one knows that that's where you're wanting to go. But what it does is it sort of hides who sent it and where it's going on the internet. The only people who sort of know are the end and the beginning points. Everything in between is sort of mixed up. So, you know, always try and keep yourself cyber safe. Ethan, do you have a skeptic?
Well, maybe I'll promote myself a little bit. I recently started tweeting, so you can follow me at Ethan Clow on Twitter, and I occasionally retweet Radio Free Thinker stuff. So follow me. In the meantime, I'm actually looking at a few projects here for CITR and the station. So if you have any suggestions on ways that some critical thinking can get on the airways, I've been looking at maybe a history of music opportunity. So any suggestions on that, feel free to send me an email. I still check my Radio Free Thinker email account, so ethan@radiofreethinker.com. I will answer you if you email me. Well, maybe I will. I don't know. We'll see.
We'll see. Yes. Well, I guess that's the end of today's show. So for everyone, actually, I'm going to give one more commercial.
Okay.
Hold on for the second. We'll be right back with the close of the show.
Listen, if they're so hot, how come they're not tearing up the charts, babe?
Because you never play them, babe.
At CITR, our hosts choose the music they play. That means our charts actually reflect the tastes of music lovers, as opposed to focus groups. So if you want to know what's really tearing up the charts, get your hands on a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or go online to CITR.ca. CITR's charts are based on actual spins motivated by actual preference. No payola, no marketing, just good tunes. Refreshing, no?
And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on. Bye.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of
A $1 billion on the ground, all stretched out and uncurled, would extend about four times around the circumference of the world.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the West End at
212 Productions Limited, The Baker and the Chef, Bang on T-shirts, Bistrood Records, Dream Apparel and Articles for People, Dunleavy Snack Bar, The Fall Tattoo, Fortune Sound Club, Hid's Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Perch, Project Space, Scratch Records, Vinyl Records, and Zoo Shop.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or online at citr.ca.